con su respuesta.
Okay, great.
Si no les queda claro, con gusto les traduzco adicionalmente.
So is someone going to be running this camera over here, or there's just got a camera stationary? We're already live here already. All right, so as I said just a moment ago, this is not your normal session. This is literally just ask me whatever you want. And again, if you need to ask me in Spanish, that is fine. It's more important that you ask me what you want to say, not what you can say, because I have a translator here for the other direction. I was going to begin real quick with a couple of answers to questions I've already been asked, and then we'll go ahead and open up the floor. One of the questions that I got asked after my session yesterday was, can I use our build system with Java? Who knows the answer to that? Anyone know? I know you know. What's the answer? Yes, 100% yes, you can build Java with our system. What you have here on your screen is actually me doing the same thing. So let me go back here and show you what this actually looks like. And if you were to go and create a brand new build, we actually have templates now, as you can see, one for Ant, one for Grado, one for Maven. These are first-class solutions. You're no longer an afterthought. No longer, yeah, you can, but you got to do these funny things. No. You want to create a new build? Just tell us what type of build for Java you want. We'll go ahead and create that for you. I've done that already. So I dropped in my Maven task. I told it where my POM file was, and that's all I had to do. If I go back and look at the results here, what you're going to see is that I was able to not only run my JUnit test, but even calculate code coverage of my JUnit test, right? It's very, very simple. And that this ties into our release management system. Now, what I did is I used a technique called Azure Resource Manager templates. It's a implementation of infrastructure as code. It's where I actually describe the infrastructure that I want. I then give that infrastructure to a task. That task then spins up the infrastructure. In this case, it was very specific. That task here, this Azure Resource Manager, this resource group deployment, I created a JSON file. And in that JSON file, it says, I want an Azure web app that has Tomcat configured and Java 8 configured so that it will host a Java application for me. And that second task there is actually spinning up that website for me if it does not already exist. If it already exists, it just says, hey, everything's good. It already exists. The task above it, that WAR converter, that is a custom task that I wrote. It's on GitHub. You can go get it. If it's not on GitHub, I'll put it there. I think it's on GitHub. I put most of my stuff on GitHub so I can share it. But what that task does is that a WAR file is just a fancy zip file. That's all it is. Now, that task underneath where it says Azure Web App Deployment, it expects the zip file to have a certain folder structure that the WAR file did not have. So all I had to do was figure out how do I extract the WAR file, put it in the right folder structure, and just zip it back up again. That's what the first task does for me. And then I just give the resulting zip file to the normal out-of-the-box Azure task. And he goes and gives it to Azure, he extracts it, and then voila, my web app is actually working for me. So can I use it for Java? Absolutely. And if you need to do anything special, you can write your own task like I did, or I could have done the same thing with the command line or anything else like that. Another question that I got asked was, Donovan, I saw you did a demo yesterday where you actually brought a iOS simulator to a Windows device. How in the world did you do that? Okay. What you have to do is make sure that when you're actually using Xamarin on both, Xamarin Xcode is on the Mac side. You have to use it's called an alpha channel, where all the alpha bits are, the brand new bits. Make sure you get the latest version of the alpha bits in Xcode. You do the exact same thing over here in the Windows side. And what you're going to end up with is this little checkbox right here. Remote simulator to Windows. So instead of the simulator being spun up on the Mac, it's actually brought over to the Windows device. This leads me to another question I got asked yesterday. A guy after was like, oh, I'm so excited. I finally get to do iOS development without a Mac. I obviously was not clear that I still needed the Mac. What we're trying to do is reduce how much you have to touch the Mac, but you still need it, right? So every time I compile, it's actually compiling it on the Mac. And then what we do is we take the resulting binary, we bring it back over to the PC, right? Whenever I spin up the simulator, before this option, the simulator would spin up on the Mac. And you'd have to turn over to the Mac and use it, turn back around and debug the problem, turn back around, use the simulator again. It was just painful. So what we thought would be really nice is if we could just bring that simulator over to the Windows machine for you, but it's still technically running on the Mac. Okay, so there's a couple ways that you can actually get to a Mac. You can buy a Mac or have one on stage like I did, or you can go to one of our partners called Mac and Cloud. Mac and Cloud is a partner of Microsoft, and you can go to their website right now and say, I would like to have a Mac in the cloud that has the build agent already on it. And it will ask you a couple questions, it'll wire it up for you, and instantly, inside of your Visual Studio Team services, you will have a Mac build machine. And then you'll be able to do all the magical stuff that I did on stage. Nothing that I did on stage was black magic. None of it was smoke and mirrors. You can do everything that I did, you can do it today, right? So the other one that was really popular that I've been asked several times about was, how in the world did you do that live documentation? You remember that demo? It's the first demo I did. On the left-hand side, I had documents, and then on the right-hand side, I had a file actually running the documents. Well, the way that you do that is called a product called Inspector. So it's called Xamarin Inspector. It's in preview right now, and you can just go and download the Xamarin Inspector. And then what you do is you load the documentation into this program. The documentation is just a special Markdown file. So everyone's familiar with Markdown? So it's basically a Markdown, but it has a workbook extension, I think is what they changed the extension to. And inside of it, you can actually designate what part of it is code and what part of it is just for people to actually be able to read. And then what you end up with is the application that I showed you yesterday. Now, in GitHub, there are people who are creating sample workbooks that you can actually load into the inspector and then be able to learn that new documentation, that new API. Right? So I downloaded mine from here, and it's just a simple Android animation document that I used yesterday. Okay, so for those who are curious on how I did my demos, the iOS simulator, it's all in the alpha channel. So just go get the latest on your Xcode side, get the latest on the Visual Studio side, and then all of a sudden you should see that checkbox and you just check it and the simulator comes over. For the workbook, you simply go here and get the workbook samples, install the inspector, and the inspector will start working. So I think those were the majority of the questions I was asked already. Java support, obviously. And I want to go ahead and reiterate one more time, not just Java support. What was I kept saying yesterday? Any language, any platform. Exactly. Any language, any platform. So when I leave here and you run up to me and say, Donovan, can I do PHP? I'm just going to say, any language, any platform. Okay? Hey, can I do Ruby? Any language, any platform. I will sound like a broken record because that is what I need you guys to leave here understanding. Visual Studio Team Services, Team Foundation Server is for any language targeting any platform. So now I'm going to go ahead and we're going to start asking, you can ask me whatever questions you'd like to ask me. I think this gentleman in the
back. Let me start with David, who was asking before even we started. But
here, we have a microphone here too, so we'll do two things. We'll get the question on recorder and then, so pass that one around and then you can translate for me.
Dos preguntas. Uno, las herramientas que se muestran ahí solo está para la versión en la nube o para la versión on-premise?
The things that you see there on the screen, are they available on the cloud for only, or is it available also on TFS on-premise?
Oh, great question. All right, so there's two differences between on-prem and the cloud. The cadence is the number one difference. Every 3 weeks, we add new features to what's on in the cloud. I'll give you a perfect example. I was telling this story earlier. On Monday of last week, I did a demo. Oh, this is released. Let me go back to build. And when I did the demo on Monday, I was telling them how you can create a new build definition, and I clicked on this button. On Monday, none of the Java stuff was there. None of this was there on Monday. I then went and had another customer meeting on Tuesday, and I clicked on the button, and I was kind of shocked because all of a sudden, all these new Java things were like in the box, right? So we are constantly, remember the definition of DevOps? Constantly delivering value, and we do that at Microsoft. At a moment's notice, there will simply be new features available to you. On-prem, it's every 3 months. Okay. So we just announced at Build that the marketplace and all these extensions are now on-prem, but you have to be on update 2 of Team Foundation Server on-prem.
Okay.
So, are they there? Yes. Are they there at the same time frame? No. If you don't see it on-prem, just give us till our next update. Because if you already see it here in the VSTS, it's basically ready for the next update that we're going to do on-prem. Okay. Great.
¿Algo más?
Sí. En la pantalla inicial hablaba sobre los web tests que se podían ejecutar ahí. Puedo ejecutar para probar cualquier aplicación que no esté hecha en TFS. Y si hay, si sabe una comparación sobre el Global Service Monitor que traes con...
So, at the initial screen, you had a series of web tests. And so, can you do web execution against applications that are not web apps, right?
Cualquier aplicación, sí.
Yeah. And then he has a question about the, what's a scum
Global
piece?
Global Service Monitor.
Global Service Monitor from scum.
Global Service Monitor from scum, I'm going to have to punt that to someone else who does more system center stuff. That's not my area of expertise.
Okay.
I will answer the question about the web test. Now, I believe, and correct me wrong, are you asking if we can use web tests to test web technology that doesn't have a user interface? Like a microservice or a web service or, yeah, okay, great. I'm actually a really big fan of our web test technology. It's actually pretty old. We've had it for quite some time, and we've been maturing it for quite some time. Now, everyone seems to want to go to Selenium, and they want to go over to Coded UI. Now, there's a time for each one of those. Web tests are a technology, they're like a protocol level test. Anything that sends an HTTP request and has an HTTP response can be tested with a web test. Anything. Your website, your web service, your WCF service, if it actually puts bits on the wire and then gets them back through HTTP protocol, I can test that with a web test. The difference between a web test and a Selenium test is when I play back the web test, there's no user interface. There's no browser installed, nothing. We literally take the request that you recorded and we put it back on the wire and then we wait for the response from the server and then we interrogate that response to make sure it matches whatever criteria you've defined in your test. Now, what's nice about that is that you can run those at load very easily. Because there's no user interface, I can spawn 1,000 threads on my machine, each thread running the exact same test, and then it looks like 1,000 requests going to your server so that we can test its performance and things like that. Does that answer the question?
En lo que yo más iba en el web test, por ejemplo, cuando lo corro local, el resultado lo graba y lo almacena. En el modelo Visual Studio, el resultado va almacenando el histórico. ¿Hay un costo extra por almacenar el histórico de las ejecuciones?
So, when he runs it local, he can maintain a historical. When you run it here, is there an additional cost to maintain the historical results of those tests? I guess the next question for you would be, how long do we keep those the historicals so you can go back and look at it?
I don't actually know, because... there's a load test tab here, but I honestly don't know
how long we keep
that data.
How long do you need to keep the data?
But I know there's no cost to store the data. There's cost to run the test, right? So you're paying for what we call virtual minutes, virtual user minutes, and you get so many of them per month. And every time you run a web test, depending on how many people you're simulating and how long you run the test, we deduct from that pool of minutes you get for free. I think it's 10,000 or something right. Like that. And then after you eclipse that, you start charging you for it. You can download any of these test runs yourself to your hard drive and keep them for as long as you want. But I honestly do not know how long we keep them in the cloud for you.
Una última.
Last one.
¿Hay forma de integrar la versión en la nube con la local?
Is there a way to integrate the cloud version and the on-premise version? Sí. I think you mean to synchronize the two in some way?
¿Cuál es el problema? Por reglas de seguridad de la empresa, yo no puedo hostear mi código en la nube.
Yes.
Tengo que tenerlo local.
Uh-huh.
Pero la parte de pruebas, ejecutar, okay. Tener parte...
From a regulatory perspective or company policy, he cannot keep the source code on the cloud, but from a testing perspective, and I guess even release, you can run it on the cloud. So is there a way to maintain both the code... the source code in his own premise, but then to do the rest on the cloud.
Absolutely, because when we're running a load test, we're running it against a deployed version of your application. I don't need the source code, right? What I need is a deployed instance of your website. And then when you deploy it, your source code could live anywhere. It's the binary and the HTML that we're uploading to the server. And once that's there, we can hit it with our load test for you.
Okay.
Okay.
But you can trigger the bin.
Of course, I don't think those are good anymore.
I know. found all the money and now.
Exactly. Yeah. There's no more. There's no use for it.
Can you trigger the build on my premises?
Ah, okay. So you
orchestrate.
You have TFS on-prem, and you're wanting to know if we can trigger a build on-prem from where? Where's your source code though? Is your source code also? Yeah. So that's not a problem, right? Because Visual Studio Team Services and Team Foundation Server are the same product, right? So everything that you saw me do on stage, as long as it's in the update of on-prem, you can duplicate the exact same thing on-prem. So Git support, TFVC support for source control, all happens in TFS on-prem as well. So if you commit there, the build will happen there. So absolutely, absolutely.
I have a couple of questions. One is, how do you approach the infrastructure team to begin implementing DevOps if they have their DAOs or there's some licensing issues?
Okay, licensing issues, you're just going to have to pay to get them licenses to get to TFS so that they'll be able to check in their infrastructure's code. I have an interview. I have a channel on Channel 9, and there's an interview there with me and David Tessar. David Tessar is, it's interesting because I am 20 years developer. He's almost just as many years infrastructure. But he's a huge DevOps guy. So he understands the importance of DevOps. And we basically have like a 37, 38-minute interview of each other talking about how to do exactly what you just asked, which is how do we get that infrastructure guy to understand that we need you to do different things. We don't need you to go away, which is really important point of that meeting. We're not, with DevOps, we're not trying to remove operations, right? It's the collaboration between dev and ops, not dev getting rid of ops. Ops still has an important role to play. But for us to be able to automate what they've done in the past, we have to be able to store their information, that knowledge, somewhere where it can be acted upon by a machine or a tool or a product. So infrastructure as code, the chef recipes that you create, the cookbooks, those have to be stored somewhere so that the tools can then use them. So what we've noticed is that infrastructure people have to learn new techniques. Like most of them don't know how to use source control because they've never had to before, right? The scripts that they run live in a folder on a thumb drive. They've never had to version them before. So they have to learn new muscles so that they can learn PowerShell. If you're an infrastructure guy and you do anything with Windows and you're not learning PowerShell, that's your own fault, right? Because that's where we're all going. And what we're going to be doing with tools like Visual Studio Team Services and TFS is automating the execution of those PowerShell scripts. But those PowerShell scripts are just as valuable as the source code in which we're trying to develop. So you should protect those assets just like you would protect everything else. So put them in version control. So we've had a lot of ops guys who have to basically learn version control, understand the concepts behind it, and then understand that we're not trying to get rid of you, right? Because a lot of them I've noticed are very fearful of this conversation because they think we're trying to automate them out of a job. But what I find is interesting is when I speak to operations guys, their jobs as when they hired on are not the jobs that they do today. And what I want to do is give you your old job back. Because your job today is to protect the environment from the developers, right? It's literally what your job is. Your job is to play defense and say, no, the developer can't touch the machine because every time he touches the machine, it crashes. Right? Because I put this code on there that you don't like. So what ends up happening? I now have to package up my code, and I have to write this horrible document, and I don't know a developer on earth who likes to write documents. Yeah. Right? We hate it. But now you're telling me to write down everything that I do to deploy my code. I then give the code to the ops guy, along with my binary, and this poor guy has to read this horrible document, try to follow the instructions to deploy my code. And guess what? It doesn't work. If you think the code I wrote was bad, wait till you read that document. It's much worse than the code that I wrote. Exactly. And even worse than that is that when I'm on the server myself as a developer and something goes wrong, I immediately make the corrective actions. I don't remember to write in the document, if this happens, then don't forget to go try to do this, right? So the document is never going to be as good. However, if I could automate that, then the document becomes the scripts. The document becomes the infrastructure's code. And now we can agree, we can read this together. The ops guy can say, yes, you need a template that has a web app with Tomcat and Java in it. And he can write that part. And I can say, great. And once you give me that, I'm going to then write this part that's going to copy my files there for you. And we can collaborate on that in a way that's much more powerful than a document that I write in Word, right? That's never going to be accurate, never be up to date. So it becomes, and guess what? If we do that as infrastructure, then your job as an infrastructure guy isn't to install my software anymore. It's to make sure that we're running on the best configured infrastructure that we can. And that was your job originally, to understand switches and load balancers and how much memory I need and what size VM that I need. That was his job, to make sure that this application that I write as a developer has the best chances possible to run the most efficiently as it can in that infrastructure, not to install the software. So all I'm trying to do is give the ops guy their job back. Stop installing my software and start literally crafting and building the best infrastructure that we can. So I think when I'm able to have that conversation with the ops guy and say, I'm not trying to replace you. I'm trying to enable you to do things that you've never been able to do before, then that fear goes away. Because I still want them. I still need them. As a developer, I don't want to know anything about that stuff. Right? I just want to go write more bugs. I mean, more code, I mean.
The other question is, you showed yesterday the analyzers. And you put the analyzers in the...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I have a question. What is the difference with the code analysis that Visual Studio has?
All right, code analysis is the ability for... It's like, are you familiar with FXCOP from the old days? Right? FXCOP was a static code analysis. It reads your code and then applies these rules to it to determine if you're breaking style rules, if you're doing things that don't perform well, making careless errors. It's the next best thing to a manual code review. Like I said, I've been writing software. Does anyone remember Compact Computers? Anyone remember that company? Yeah, so you're all old like me. But we used to do real code reviews, where once a week, we'd all bring our own lunch, we'd sit in a conference room, and some poor sap had to put his code up on the projector, right? And we would sit there, and we would just dissect what he'd done and ask him questions on why he designed it that way. I think that's a fantastic way to do code reviews, because what's inevitable there is that I'll see a piece of code that he wrote that's exactly like a piece of code that I wrote. I didn't even realize, like, wow, I wrote that same method. Why don't we collapse that, put it in a library where we can both reuse it and not have this legacy code or this duplicate code running around? If you don't have time to do that, and most teams will argue that they don't, static code analysis is the next best thing, right? Code cloning, which is another feature that we have inside Visual Studio, will basically go and say, hey, I just realized that two of you guys have written very similar code. Maybe you need to refactor that so that it actually works better. So that's what the analysis is for. Is that answering the question? Or? Oh, yeah. I think actually Corey showed that. Was it Corey or Hunter showed that? I think Hunter showed that where, yeah, when you expanded your references, there was a new analyzers, all the Roslyn analyzers. That's basically the next generation of FXCOP. Those were just the rules that you want to apply against your code, but they're much smarter than they used to be. In the past, FXCOP would just be warnings, and then you might be able to go to a help file, and the help file would tell you what to do. But now the analyzers are smart enough to actually tell you and actually fix your code for you. So now they're just NuGet packages. So it's, go ahead.
Do you get rid of Visual Studio feature where you right-click on the project and run code analysis right
now? I think that's still there right now. You can still go to analyze and you can still run that particular feature. And I think the option will stay there. It's just you're going to be running the Roslyn analyzers and not the FXCOP rules that are assigned in your project.
Well, he showed it's not available
today. Right, and again, that wasn't me. That was actually Scott Hunter,
who
I don't think is in here.
Not available yet.
It's in a preview bits. Yeah, and he has preview bits with him. So if you find him, you can actually start playing with that.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, that's right. He left last night, didn't he? That's where Scott left. That's why they were asking where Scott was.
Yeah.
Okay, good afternoon. The question is related, I have two questions. The first one is related with the possibility to use NUnit or XUnit with the normal flow in the delivery pipeline. And also the second question is related with the NoSQL database support, for example, Elasticsearch or something like this. In your previous
session,
you mentioned that maybe we can use SQL data tools, SQL Server data tools, but this is not possible to Elasticsearch or something NoSQL products. So what is your recommendation?
All right. First question, can I run XUnit, MBUnit, InUnit, and all those other type of testing frameworks? Absolutely, you can. There's a couple of things that we can do there for you. Any testing framework you can run inside Visual Studio, you can run inside of our build system. Okay. Just that simple. Now, some of the things that get a little different there is how do we publish the results? Because each one of those testing frameworks have a different format in which they save the test results, and I'll show you how you get around that. So let's just go and edit any one of these guys here. And then what we're going to do is I'll show you that we have a test task here. So it says basically, where are you? Visual Studio test. So anything that you've added in Visual Studio gets compiled into a DLL. XUnit, MBUnit, InUnit, MS Test, all those testing frameworks get compiled into a DLL. All this is saying is go find any DLL that has the word test in it, assuming your naming convention, put the word test in your test DLLs. We're going to go run all those tests for you, period. Okay? Now, when you're trying to run XUnit against ASP.NET 5, which requires DNU, things get a little bit trickier. But I've said this over and over again. I'll say it one more time. Anything I can do from a command line, I can do from our build. And then running XUnit with ASP.NET 5 using DNX, you can do it from the command line. So that's exactly what I would do in that weird scenario, right? And hopefully that we're going to make that better once ASP.NET 5 RTMs. Now, if you're running this right here, will understand 90% of the test results and automatically publish them as part of your output. But if you ever have one that's we don't understand quite yet, if we come over here to add another one, and I think it's also under the test tab, it's published test result. There we go. And this guy allows us to tell you what type of test did I run already so that you can go find the test result file so that you can then publish them in a way that we understand. So as you'll see there, InUnit is there, JUnit, VS Test, which is MSUnit, and then XUnit. So we understand all those types of tests already. What's not up here, we also understand Mocha. We also understand Jasmine. So if you guys are doing unit testing of your JavaScript, we can actually run those for you as well. And another thing that I really like here is you're doing something like Maven. I love this one. Maven actually has the ability to run tests built inside of the task. So just by adding this one task, I get rid of those other two tasks. Because Maven says, oh, I'm going to go run all your JUnit tests. I can even go down there. You see where it says code coverage tool? I simply say I want to use Jacoco, and it immediately gives me code coverage as well. Right? So we are trying to allow you to run any testing framework that you want. Now, let's assume that tomorrow some company comes out with a brand new testing framework that I've never heard of before. You can run that testing framework too, even though we don't know about it yet. All you would do is come over here, you would go to the utility tab, and you would either run a command, or you would be able to run this arbitrary PowerShell. This is, we just upgraded this task, by the way. In the past, you used to have to give us a script. That script had to be in source control somewhere, right? So I had to add this file to my source control. When I did a get latest, it would come down. And some people didn't like polluting their source control with these random script files that only did something very simple. So we changed it for you to where you can actually go and say, you know what? I just want to run an inline arbitrary piece of PowerShell. I don't want to store this inside of my source control. I just want to call out to that newfangled unit testing framework, and I want to run it right now. And then using that task and the published test results, you would be able to have the same first-class experience that you have with any other testing framework. Does that answer the testing question?
Yeah.
Okay, so what was the other question?
Well, it was related with the with the integration with the NoSQL
database.
Yeah,
you did. Yeah, this NoSQL battery. Yeah, SSDT. Okay. So we're talking about how do we handle databases throughout our DevOps pipeline? That's generally the question, right?
Yes.
Okay. So when you're dealing with SQL Server, you have a couple options. One of them is SQL Server Data Tools, which is the one that I showed in my second demo yesterday, where it's a project inside of Visual Studio that understands the schema and then produces what we call a DACPAC file. The DACPAC is a digital fingerprint of the schema of the database. I can then give it to one of the tasks here. Matter of fact, I'll show it to you. So if we were to come to here again, there is a task. I think it's going to be under deploy. Here it is right here. So this task here basically says, tell me where your DACPAC file is, and it'll be an output of our build. And then you tell me the connection string to the database that you want, and then I will go update it for you. That's great for SQL Server. You asked about other database types. If you're doing anything beyond SQL Server, SSDT is out. It does not support that. However, we have a partnership with a company that does handle the rest of that for you. So if I come back over here and browse my marketplace, hopefully they're still featured. This company right here, Redgate, they were first in this whole arena, right? I mean, we basically took a lot of their cool functionality and put it inside the box, inside of SSDT, but they support MySQL and Oracle and all those other databases. I don't know if they do NoSQL. I don't know yet. But this would be the first place I'd go and look. Is see, is there a partner who already understands the database that I'm trying to target, and do they have an extension? Majority of them are going to be able to use Redgate. NoSQL is the only one I'm not certain off the top of my head if we have support for or not. But this is the route that I would go, or I would basically write my own. Writing extensions and tasks is very easy.
Okay.
Good?
Yep.
Okay, great. Who else has a question?
¿Alguien más?
It's going to be a really short session if you guys don't have any questions.
Son gratis. Sin cobro. Sin pena.
Anything from the sessions I've done already, something that's coming in the future, you can literally ask me anything. You can ask me about air hockey, racing cars, or there we go. Cool deal.
Well, if there are nothing else.
There's no other questions? this is me and you now, me and you.
Okay, so for example, in our organization, we are trying to adopt DevOps, WDP pipeline. The problem usually is with the legacy code that we need to move. What is your recommendation to try to apply the DevOps to existing brownfield applications?
Oh, good question. Step number one, I think the easiest way to get going, do you have continuous integration on that product yet?
Yes. At the moment, we are using Jenkins.
Perfect. Oh, sorry, you already have continuous integration, which is normally the first place I tell people to start, right? Let's just start building it upon every single check-in. Then the next thing I would do is try to automate the deployment of that application. So you clearly know how to deploy it today. It's a brownfield application that you've been deploying for years, potentially manually, right? Or maybe you have a battery of scripts that you run to go and deploy that. I would start automating the deployment of that application as much as I possibly could. It might not even be all of it on day one. It might be a series of scripts that you already have that we're now going to put inside of release management. I'll show you how we'll do that. We're basically going to go inside of release management and start adding the same task that I just told you about a second ago, where we might basically just start running some PowerShell scripts to copy files to the right locations, just getting us a little bit closer to that fully automated step. And then maybe users on day one are still going to have to go do a couple of the steps. And then we're going to realize, hey, there's an API that allows me not to have to do that, right? To where if I wrote another PowerShell script, that step I just did manually, I could automate. And then I would add that other PowerShell script to my task. And eventually we would go from just CI in a semi-manual deployment to a fully deployed, fully automated deployment from the system.
Yeah. In your opinion, what is the necessity of the relation that maybe we need to focus on the agile and also microservice related with the DevOps context?
All right. So to me, that's two different questions. One of them was how important is agile to DevOps, and the other one was should we go to microservices? I'll answer the first one first. I believe to be effective at DevOps, you need to be good at Agile. Sam Guckenheimer, one of our really influential members at Microsoft, is like a visionary for us, describes DevOps as the second decade of Agile. Right? 10 years ago, Agile was this fad that was going to die out, and we were all going to go back to waterfall once we proved that Scrum didn't work. 10 years later, we realized it works really, really well. Now, a lot of teams claim to be Agile who aren't. Right? They're just basically short waterfalls. Right? There's a difference between doing waterfall really, really quickly and being agile. Okay? So I think you need to be really, really good at being an agile shop. You need to be producing value on a regular cadence. And then the challenge becomes, how do I deliver that value to the end users? Because producing value and delivering value, those are drastically different statements. Our team can be running at 2-week sprints producing value, but our end users are never seeing any of that code. Because to get that code off of my developer's machine or off my build machine and onto that production server takes weeks, months, if not multiple months to do. And then you're failing when it comes to DevOps. So I think you need to be good at Agile. You need to be producing value on a regular basis. And then what you do is you take that value and you deploy it as quickly as you possibly can. To deploy quickly almost necessitates the need for automation. Humans are the biggest bottleneck in any DevOps pipeline. And we do our best to mitigate the need for that, but there are times where you still need them to be approval, and guess what? That's the part that takes forever. Waiting for someone to go back in there and give their thumbs up. Waiting for the human being, the human factor of DevOps is the worst one, which is why automation is almost synonymous with DevOps, right? A lot of people think that DevOps equals automation, and it doesn't. Automation is just an enabler for the DevOps transformation. So even a brownfield application, I would start the way that I was talking about before, but agile, I feel you gotta be good at agile first. Microservices, that's a completely different discussion, right? Microservices all depends on what you're writing, right? And your particular target audience and how it's distributed, how the infrastructure hosts it. I'll use us as an example. Team Foundation Server, when it was originally written, was a monolith. What I meant by that is just like it was one huge application that you installed on your app tier, and it was backed by SQL Server. And then we started to realize that when we moved it to the cloud, that's not always a good architecture. I think I shared this with one of our customers today. You almost need to rethink your application when you really want to be cloud aware. Where your resources live is going to be different. The way that you scale up and scale down your resources is drastically different. Lifting and shifting an application does not always get you the results that you want. That's what we did with Team Foundation Server. When we put it in the cloud, we literally lifted and shifted it. And we've learned so much about what went really, really wrong and how we've had to re-architect our application. So is microservices the right answer? Not for everyone. Right? It all depends on what it is that you're writing. And what we're trying to do in Visual Studio Team Services is get to that world because it's applicable for us. It's the right answer for a service like Visual Studio Team Services. When we added package management, we didn't add it as part of the monolithic solution. We added it as a separate service intentionally because let's say, for example, we were to have a live site incident. A live site incident is when the service goes down and we have to get it back up. If you have this big monolithic application and the CPU spikes, which part of that application just caused the CPU to spike? I don't know. But if I have package management running on its own cluster of servers that is just a microservice of the bigger picture and that CPU spikes, I know exactly who the problem is. It's the package management. We can go fix that and address it much more quickly than the needle in the haystack of that monolithic application that we're trying to go and fix.
It's easier also to try to provide a good fit in the testing strategy for microservices. I suppose that because, for example, in a monolithic application, you have a lot of tests, I don't know, two or three hours of testing.
Sure.
In microservice, you have a small piece of software, so you can
absolutely
cover your code.
No argument. Yeah. All the benefits of microservices are true. Do I have to write every application that I write as a microservice? I don't think that that's true. So that's what I'm saying is that I am a big fan of microservices. That's why we're moving VSTS there. But for VSTS, it's a good answer. I don't know that it's an answer for everyone. That's all I'm saying. It's just another tool in your toolbox that you need to evaluate and see, do microservices make sense? For us, it makes a lot of sense because if it's a monolith, let's say, for example, source control is becoming really, really popular. Everyone's realizing that VSTS gives us unlimited private repos. So we're going to take all of our code and we're going to start shoving it into VSTS. We're not going to use any other parts of VSTS. We're just going to use source control. But if that became really popular, from our perspective, we would now have to scale up the entire solution just to deal with the new input of source control, which means that we're buying bigger boxes and we're wasting a lot of that capacity because they're not using work item tracking, they're not using continuous integration, they're not using build, but because they're so tightly coupled, I'm forced to use this big resource, multiple of them, just to deal with source control. If source control was its own microservice, I could then scale up just the source control part and wait for everyone else to start realizing that, oh, I want to use those other features, and then scale those up when I need to, not because I have to because it's a monolith. Follow that logic there? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's it might be good for you, it might be overkill for you. So it just depends.
Okay, thank you.
Great.
Otra pregunta, inquietud. Yo no la voy a responder,
perfect.
O sea que están de buenas.
And then we'll come back to you.
Buenas. En español, ¿es posible desarrollar aplicaciones en Android pero con Java nativo?
Is it possible to develop Android apps in native Java?
Okay, great question. I'll show you that real quick. Yes. First task, right? So we were very deliberate. We want to be the best solution, period, when it comes to mobile DevOps. Xamarin and Cordova are relatively new to that space. A lot of our customers were doing mobile development long before those technologies existed. We cannot expect you to go rewrite everything in Xamarin or go rewrite everything in Cordova now that they're here. We know that you have investments in Android Studio and the SDK, pure Java. We also know that there's people who have written Xcode and Objective-C for their iOS. We're not leaving any of those people out. Where however you want to develop your application, any language, any platform. That platform includes iOS, Android, Raspberry Pi, Arduino, Xbox, any language, Ruby, Java, Perl, yell out a language, yes. I will help you build that. Where you want to deploy it, yell out a platform, yes, including AWS and Google. I don't care where you want to run your application. I can get it there for you.
You gave us a lot of tips on what we should do when trying to implement or going into the DevOps path.
Sure.
But what we shouldn't do, what mustn't do.
Yeah, that's just as powerful of a question as what should we not do. And that's a good one. I'm actually going to have an interview with Sam. I can't tell you how much respect I have for this individual, right? So what I'm going to do is I have a show on Channel 9, and we're going to talk about anti-patterns. So there's going to be DevOps anti-patterns, where he and I, what's going on? Oh, wow, ice cream. Gracias. For those who don't know, I have the world's biggest sweet tooth, and I'm going to be distracted now, but I'm going to eat that while I talk to you guys. What should you not do? I would say don't try doing it all overnight. Right? That's be my best. You can build your DevOps pipeline over time. Right? For you to say, that's it, tomorrow we're gonna switch over and we're going to be 100% DevOps tomorrow, I think that would be a losing battle. Right? I also, this is going to sound weird, I wouldn't ask for permission. I would just do it. I think trying to go ask for permission to do the right thing is ridiculous. Because the people that have you doing it the same way that you've been doing it for 30 years clearly do not see the value. And very few of them are over your shoulder every day that you're writing, even asking you how you're writing it. Very few of them are saying you must do waterfall. They're just saying you must deliver this by this particular date. That's usually what people are saying. And historically, we've been doing it waterfall. So fine, the next project, I'm just going to do it agile. I'm still going to hit the date, probably with higher quality code, and faster than we would have before. So don't go ask for permission. Just do the right thing for your company. And then what's going to happen is that your CEOs and CIOs are going to start to see benefit and be wondering, how in the world are you developing this software so quickly? How are you having me look at new functioning software every 2 weeks? You've never done this before. Oh, yeah, we're doing this thing called agile. Oh, that's awesome. You can do that on all projects? Yeah, and we can get the same result everywhere. But if I sat down with you and said, I want to try this radical new thing on the next project, they're immediately going to say no. No, 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 no. This is really, really important. We got to hit that date. Let's just do what we know. What we know is, if we do what we know, we won't make the date. That's what I know for certain. If I do what we've been doing for 30 years, we will not make the date. Right? So why don't you just say, I just nod and smile and say, okay, we're going to, great. And then I go back and I do the right thing for my company. Right? And I do it, but you got to succeed. That's the catch-22 here. You got to succeed. I should do a session on Scrum one of these days because I am a huge fan. And one of the things that I do whenever I take over a team, I used to get literally dropped into a hostile environment and say, Donovan, we need you to go fix this team. And what I would do is I would sit down for 90 minutes and I would do this session with them. And I wouldn't just have the developers in the room with me. I had everyone who was going to talk to that team in that room with me. Because you can't just fix the team. You have to fix everyone who talks to the team. Because if they're talking waterfall, but we're running agile, there's going to be a disconnect there. There's going to be literally a mismatch that's going to make it very painful. But if everyone understands the words, everyone understands the vocabulary, they understand why we're doing these rituals, that fear goes away because they now understand. Fear is driven by the fact that I don't understand what you're doing. I don't know it, so I'm afraid of it. But if you educate, and I mean everyone, not just the 9 guys on your team, but the stakeholders and the product owners and the people who are outside looking in, be 100% transparent. And to do that, I had to educate everyone. But when I did that, I had a higher rate of success because people understood the words and the terms and the rules on which we were running it by. So don't ask for permission. Go do the right thing. That would be the one thing I'd tell you. Don't do it all overnight. Get your CI going. Add unit tests to your CI. After that, go get some deployment done. It doesn't have to be 100% automated on day one. But get Visual Studio in there. Get the Visual Studio Team Services helping with your deployment. There might still be some manual steps there that you will automate at a later date. But just start getting that motion. Start getting that muscle so that you start to get comfortable with the tools. And the next thing you know, you guys are going to be more productive than you've ever been. Good?
I think I would add to Donovan's point, just because you implemented the tool, don't expect the process to be successful. Because it is the people and it is the process that you have to also change. The tool doesn't, is, we talked, I talked yesterday with Donovan, it is putting training wheels on your bicycle, but it's not, doesn't teach you how to ride the bike.
One of the biggest anti-patterns is, I remember I was installing TFS at this company. I just finished, and the guy looks up and says, oh, thank God we have TFS. Now we can do Scrum right. I'm like, hold up. You could have done Scrum right long before I installed this product, right? Scrum has nothing to do with this tool, right? You can do it right with sticky notes on a whiteboard. So if you are putting all your eggs in the whole, I get the right product or I get the right tool and now we'll be successful, you got it all wrong. The people and the process, those are the most important parts, okay? All we're doing with products is enabling the other two, right? Enabling them, right? We're just like, yeah, now you can do them a little bit more efficiently, but you can do them without the tool, right? Don't ever think that a tool is why you're going to be successful. We're just here to help you. Now, what I have noticed is, if the product is cool enough, it will influence the people. People are more likely to use it when they see the benefits of how easy they're going to make their lives. So my job as part of the product group is, how do I make this tool or this product so cool that people want to use it so that I can help change their perspective and then I can help shape that process, right? So it's all three of them, though. Am I done? All right, good. I can eat my ice cream now. Guys, thank you so much for coming.
Gracias.
I hope to see you next year.